doing a traditional narrative case study on one of the points that's in this wider network of the kind of named entity recognition or recognized locations. But, you know, a lot of the digital humanities projects I've seen have been all quantified computational or kind of more strictly narrative driven. Is there a space, and how would something like that be designed that does both? And how do you make it clear that I chose these 100 or 1,000 maps out of the set and extracted them out in a way that's not, that's still kind of pedagogically valid to the people reading it, that doesn't just drive them. I mean, a lot of me revising my book was taking out stuff that the editor was like, yeah, people don't need to know all that. I'm like, but it seemed interesting to me. Like, this is how I put it together. And they're like, yeah, no, take that out. And so that's a question, right? You could lose somebody in the technicality of this is why I chose these, and here I'm showing them to you, kind of.
Right. But I think that, so I think the answer to that is partly in the article that you guys wrote in DHQ, right, about how, you know, for the sake of data visualization, you have all of these steps that involve human judgments, right? And there's been a lot of work in data science for the past couple of years really looking at the same problem, that at every step of picking the data, deciding which model to run, there's always some human judgment that comes into play there that can, in effectively, is effectively some level of interpretation that can lead to, it is injecting some kind of bias into the entire process to make it non-objective. So even the computational side is never going to be as completely black and white as the purely narrative side. But even taking computation out of it, I think all of this, even if you have people who are doing the maps and doing pure computation for the text, it can still fall in the same umbrella of being empirical, because you're using measurement to drive your argument, you know, as a way of you're marshaling measurement for your argument.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I wouldn't see empirical and subjective as fully mutually exclusive. I think the two, I don't even know if I'd say they're on a continuum, they just overlap.
Mm-hmm.
To raise the specter of the 18th century and the encyclopedie, and just thinking about the representation of these spaces across time, I do think that's really an interesting comparison, and worth doing, especially if sort of in the long tail of your project, you can then get back to sources produced in these other
mm-hmm.
parts of the world. Because that's what we can't really do with the encyclopedie, is we can't go, you know, we don't have corpora for the 18th century that are not produced by French people themselves, that are in French, that are kind of comparable, or that's not in the scope of what we're doing. But I mean, I'm really interested in how what you will find about the ways that places are described, what kinds of information about people and environment and events, you know, surrounds those places, and how that compares to a sort of 18th century vision of the world that was written for a much smaller specialized audience. So that's, I think, what's really fascinating about the difference between these corpora is their audience, and just the fact that this is a widely distributed periodical for the general public, for schools, in comparison to something like the Encyclopédie, which had a very, you know, elite audience that may not have ever actually read it.
Well, we have no idea if anyone actually read this either. We know they bought it.
Yeah, but they bought more copies of it than they
that's
did the Encyclopédie over a longer period of time. Yeah.
I think you're raising two really interesting points. One, what's practical to do with what's available, getting back to the scope question. But two, and maybe this is more for the librarians to help with, but how much of our resources at this point should go toward answering scholarly questions, and how much should be put toward building something that someone else can ask questions of, right? Because you listed people, the environment. I would love to ask questions about the environment, given my research background, but also I have to make choices. And so, and those choices, when we get into like user interface, you have to tailor the user interface to the question that you asked and how you're going to present it. But you also, you know, in my mind, I don't want to close off someone else. So how could we build it with modularity and extensibility in mind? So that somebody could come along and ask an entirely different question.
But I think that's really, that should be the, I mean, it seems to me from what I've read of the grant that that's what you proposed.
Yeah.
Is that you're going to create a corpus that can be used by others to do
the idea, well, we would hope, pie in the sky, if we could get funding for it, would be to build the corpus with a mind toward how other people could ask questions of it and have our interface built on top of it as one shining example of an ethical way of doing it.
And
that's what we're hoping to do.
And an additional output of a workflow and methodology that is adaptable, that has some modularity, isn't so customized to our data and our subject that it will not be useful to other people.
And that's what excited the NEH, because so many projects out there are so custom tailored to the specific data that someone else can't come along and ask a new question of it. Or it's on the other end of it, that there's a data set available, but then the interfaces built on top of it are kind of one-offs or aren't. It would be great if someone else came along and asked the environment question, if that somehow could be incorporated into the kind of ecosystem of the project, rather than it being a one-off somewhere else or just showing up in X, Y, or Z monograph.
Coming back to the feedback loops and iteration that we want, ideally, to build in.
I think, you know, when we talk about data sharing, a lot of the idea behind it is that there will be people who will use your data in ways you never even thought of. So you can't plan for every possibility out there, and that's just something you're going to have to accept, I would say, from the start. Obviously, you know, something like this, because if you can build an easy-to-use public interface,
mm-hmm.
that can make it easy for someone with low-tech skills, like me, to interact with the data and to do that new research, that's awesome, because otherwise I probably wouldn't have that chance to do that research. And so there is, you want to meet that fine line where the data is available and you build this wonderful interface where people can interact with it in maybe different ways than you would have imagined. Or maybe we did imagine them, but we don't have the resources to do it ourselves, so we're going to let other people do it. But at the same time, there might be people with that technological know-how, like more like you, who, if they can take that base and then they can run with it and do whatever else they want and create their own interface or their own ways to interact with the data. So I guess I think it's definitely, I would definitely vote there should be an emphasis on making sure we are making, you know, the data available to other people to use for different ways. But again, we can't imagine everything, so you need to think about what your time and resources are, how much we can, I mean, like, you can really start contacting lots and lots and lots of different people and be like, how would you want to interact with this data?
Yeah.
But again, we have limited resources. So it is a balance of how much can we anticipate and how much are we just going to say, well, the base is there, and if you want to take that, and making sure that base can be, has enough context to it that they can also use it in some other way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's why I started with, I think one of the big hopes is at the end of this, we'll have a very good sense of priorities of what we need to ask for and the way to justify it to build that base, and what maybe should come, as much as I would want to do it right now because it's the most interesting thing to me, you know, whatever it is, what should I delay gratification on and hope will come down the line? And I think my own perspective on it is I've seen a lot of digital humanities projects that I think try to get to that last point right away, and in so doing make it so that, and I'm guilty of this myself, it was great for my one research question that I wanted, but I didn't make anything that anyone else could use.
Yeah.
So even stuff, you know, the cartographic visualizations in my book, no one else is going to get those because that, you know, I made that sausage and then it was made and that was it, and I didn't build it in such a way that others could use it, and I don't want a project like this to follow suit.
And one thing that's absolutely essential when you make data available is to describe the way the data is made available.
Oh, yes.
And provide instructions. Because many, many websites have the data available, but you have to reverse engineer what they actually have available. And it takes a hell of a lot of time, and it could have just provided a simple description. What's the structure? What have we left out? What were the aims?
Yeah.
And it's just two pages A4. But it's absolutely vital if you want to use your data to have a background, instructions for use.
And metadata to discover it.
Yeah, exactly.
And rights, information, and information about who created it, what it was, who funded it, and you know when it was created. All those things are really important bits of metadata.
Providing the whole picture for it,
yeah.
And metadata
around
is huge.
The product. Think about the what you're creating as a product, and what you're gonna surround it with metadata to enable additional uses of it.
I mean, that was something that we really, in that article that David mentioned, we really praised AltStudio for, because he's the main guy behind that is protective of the data set, not because he doesn't want others to use it, but because if you were to just take it and not know, have a very good sense of all of the subjective decisions that went into making it and the reasons why these decisions were made, you could use that data to do something that would be completely contrary to the purpose of that project on American lynching. And that, you know, that presents a danger. And there, I think, given the sensitivity of this material, that danger exists. I mean, it exists already because the Gallica's already put up at least the images of these microfilms. But if we built something even more robust that, say, is keyword searchable, or you could pull up a location and build networks and stuff, and it's that automated, people could draw, you know, we don't know how they would use it.
Yeah.
And so.
It seems like there's a conversation it's very similar to the conversation that blew up last week at the AHA about historians' photos and how we save those, and can they help, you know, people do research later without having to go to the archives, and the kind of bigger conversation about reproducible science. I think suggests an effort to have a very pared down version of what you're providing for others' use. And that is an output that you produce, that's research that you produce, and that's wholly distinct from what you build on top of that, which is should be reproducible in other ways. That is a different kind of output.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, and part of me thinks, well, it's just your kind of minimal labeled XML data that should actually be available via the BNF. Because that's where people go to get. When they think, oh, I should go get the Journal de Voyage, they go to Gallica, and they go to the BNF, and a lot of text files are available from Gallica, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me that a partnership with the BNF makes sense. And you can build your thing for your, that's an exemplary use.
Yes.
And you have your model of ethical visualization, but the kind of data set of the text tagged in some useful ways, and then maybe an enriched data set that has some tagged entities which give people some, you know, examples, right?
Yeah.
But like, you can't tag every entity, and you can't segment everything, and you can't, you know, analyze everything in your data set, and you shouldn't try for all the reasons that have just been said, but I think there's like a minimal and a maximal that you can achieve for your own purposes.
So kind of build a base
and
raw-ish data set with minimal tagging at the outset, spend the resources on that, and then start building off of that and make that original one.
Yeah, because you can fork off different versions of it,
yeah.
You know, and describe what you've done differently in processing that new set.
Mm.
so that it's clear to the researchers what's changed.
Yeah.
You know, and I would assume that there's going to be different versions of this as a result, you know, products from this project anyway.
Mm.
So.
It sounds like it's sort of naturally shifting into
metadata.
We're starting to get into how about we break for a half hour of coffee and just keep in mind that we're very aware that with such disparate backgrounds and experience, we're really mindful that the informal interactions are incredibly valuable for fostering understanding and sparking ideas. So, like, we consider it very valuable and like work time, even if it doesn't feel like work time, to have a lot of coffee and lunches and dinners. So please help yourself or to drinks and we'll.
Many of you are in different time zones, so definitely caffeinate. We're all on the same plane of awareness.
Yeah, I'm gonna call you right. Say hello.
Oh, yeah.